Hey, this is John Lee Dumas from EO Fire, and you're listening to Elective Rotation with Pharmacy Joe. You must be prepared to ignite.
What's up, Pharmacy Nation? I'm Pharmacy Joe. Thank you for listening to the Elective Rotation, a critical care pharmacy podcast. This is episode 45. In this episode, I'll review an article about using melatonin to decrease the need for sedation in the ICU, answer the drug information question, how long can I take NSAIDs before I need to take GI prophylaxis, and share a resource I use when taking care of a patient with myasthenia gravis. I have all the evidence supporting today's show linked up in the show notes at pharmacyjoe.com/episode45. If you know someone who would find this podcast helpful, please share it with them. The Pharmacy Nation Slack group is a free group with other pharmacists from around the world collaborating with each other using real-time messaging to help better care for patients. I invite you to join me and the over 120 other Pharmacy Nation members there. You can sign up at pharmacynation.org. The article I'll be discussing today is titled "Melatonin Reduces the Need for Sedation in ICU Patients, a Randomized Controlled Trial." The lead author is Giovanni Mistrelletti, and it was published in the journal Minerva Anesthesiologica, December 2015. Critically ill patients suffer from physiologic sleep deprivation and have reduced blood melatonin levels. The purpose of this study was to determine whether nocturnal melatonin supplementation would reduce the need for sedation in critically ill patients. This double-blind, randomized, placebo-controlled trial was carried out in a mixed medical surgical intensive care unit in Milan, Italy. Of 1,158 patients admitted to the ICU during the study period, 82 critically ill patients with mechanical ventilation greater than 48 hours and simplified acute physiology score 2 scores greater than 32 points were randomized in a 1-to-1 fashion to receive melatonin 3 milligrams at 8 p.m. and midnight or placebo starting from the third ICU day until ICU discharge. The primary outcome was the total amount of enteral hydroxyzine administered, and I'll have more about this interesting outcome choice later. On to the results. Melatonin-treated patients received a lower amount of enteral hydroxyzine. Other neurologic indicators, such as the amount of neuroactive drugs given, pain, agitation, anxiety, sleep observed by nurses, need for restraints, need for extra sedation, and nurse evaluation of sedation adequacy seemed improved with reduced cost for neuroactive drugs in the melatonin-treated group. Post-traumatic stress disorder prevalence did not differ between groups, nor did ICU or hospital mortality. Study limitations include the differences between the groups before intervention, the small sample size, and the single-center observation. The authors concluded that long-term enteral melatonin supplementation may result in a decreased need for sedation with improved neurologic indicators and cost reduction. Further multi-center evaluations are required to confirm these results with different sedation protocols. Now, one of the more fascinating details with this article is the unique sedation protocol. I have a direct link to the protocol in the show notes at pharmacyjoe.com/episode45. The sedation protocol starts off giving propofol or midazolam by IV infusion, as is the standard in most ICUs. Within 48 hours, ICU patients are weaned off the propofol or midazolam and converted to an enteral sedation regimen using lorazepam up to 16 milligrams per day and hydroxyzine up to 600 milligrams per day. The sedation target for this protocol is a Richmond Agitation Sedation Scale of 0 to negative 1. The idea that inexpensive enteral sedation could be effective for ICU sedation, possibly with fewer side effects, is extremely interesting. There is a multicenter trial underway comparing this enteral sedation protocol to IV sedation with midazolam or propofol, according to clinicaltrials.gov. There's not enough information to adopt this protocol now, but it is certainly something I look forward to seeing more research on. I contacted the lead author for this article regarding one of his prior studies many years ago. He was very helpful to me and gave me detailed answers to my questions. He asked me to review the English language version of this manuscript since his primary language is Italian. It was a great experience, and my name appears in the acknowledgement section. Thank you, Giovanni. I've mentioned this before on the podcast, and it's worth repeating. Don't hesitate to use the correspondence email provided in every published journal article. You're nearly guaranteed to get a response from the author, and you never know where it might lead. On to the drug information question of how long can I take NSAIDs before I need to take GI prophylaxis. My answer, start right away, but only if you really need to. In the process of answering this question for a physician colleague of mine, I came across something I had never heard before. My colleague was taking ibuprofen chronically for stiffness in his hands. In my research, I determined that he was low risk for bleeding and didn't need GI prophylaxis while taking ibuprofen. To answer his question, I used the 2009 practice guidelines for prevention of NSAID-related ulcer complications. And on page 2, the guidelines state, in a large series based on autopsy findings on patients with a history of NSAID use, gastric and duodenal ulcers were found to be more common among patients who had consumed NSAIDs for less than 3 months. Then there's this curiously unreferenced statement. Although the risk of ulcer complications decreases after the first few months of NSAID use, it does not vanish with long-term therapy. Now, previous to reading this, I had no idea that the chance of a GI bleed from chronic NSAID use was higher in the first few months of therapy. If the patient is high risk for GI bleeding from NSAID therapy, start the GI prophylaxis right away. Onto the resource for today's show. I recently took care of a patient with myasthenia gravis who had post-op respiratory failure. Whenever I am involved in the care of a patient with myasthenia gravis, I review their meds against the list of meds at myasthenia.org that are known to exacerbate myasthenia gravis, and I have a direct link to this list in the show notes. After I make sure the patient is not inadvertently taking a medication that could worsen their myasthenia, I'll print out the list and place it in the chart so that clinicians can review it prior to ordering new medications for the patient. Listeners can support the show by shopping through my Amazon link at the bottom of pharmacyjoe.com or by purchasing something they find useful from my resource page at pharmacyjoe.com/resources. Thank you so much for listening. I'll see you in the next episode of the Elective Rotation.